Welcome all. Nice to be here. And particularly on this collection of articles, it strikes me that the way they overlap and the way they work together is one of the better collections that I've seen in a long, long time. Not that I agree with everything. Everybody kind of knows that I kind of get cranky sometimes about these articles, but let me just do a quick rundown, then we're going to take a poll and to let you focus in on which one to go first, and we're going to ask you to give us some thoughts about that article. So the first one, reimagining work as a product. Interesting, of course, but the idea that that people derive value from products and they derive value from work, and they don't join companies, they join work, is a kind of an interesting twist. I'm interested in hearing how your experiences are with issues like how do you design for retention? How do you design for, how do you personalize organization designs, et cetera, to individuals for targeted retention or even accelerated professional development. The second article about stepping out of the lab, that one hits home for me. I was pretty much born in the lab, and I lived in the lab for 30 years, and then stepped out into leadership development. I started off as an engineering aide and left as chief information officer after 30 years, and I worked on five of the then seven continents, which is now only six, I understand. But the idea that that leaders need to go through transitions from stage to stage in order to be successful and have successful organizations hits right on the mark with the work that I did with the results-based leadership group for 8 years. So we'll come back at that one. The next one about the digital natives. This one's interesting. I'm going to throw a twist into your thinking as you think about and discuss the article, is the idea that digital natives isn't maybe the real issue. Is it continuous transformation organizations as opposed to digital native organizations? That's the real tick, the changes that makes the difference in applying digital technologies to work and to products within organizations. So just consider that as you also discuss this one. And then we have Tessa Boshoff. This story I have retold maybe a dozen times about the idea that although I have no connection to Tessa Boshoff at all or to Wall Street English, but I do have some experience with online learning organization development and design of those organizations. And the idea that she combined, although it's not expressed explicitly, she combined the design of talent, technology, process, and culture all at once, and transform them as one major change, as opposed to thinking of them as separate tracks or doing them sequentially. They all happen together. And I'm going to put my hand up and say, bravo. It's not common to see that. The idea of agility and guardrails. If we go back to the Toyota production system, which is, I think, what they're really referring to here, is that it had a way of localizing and generalizing designs across the organization at the same time. And that seemed to work pretty well for them because they could pick up a dozen senior leaders from a high-performing plant and relocate them to a startup plant for a period of time and leapfrog competitors in terms of time to productivity and time to zero defects in getting products out the door. So the ideas of from the Sloan Management Review article, I think, are pretty powerful stuff for us too. Any questions? Anybody who didn't read any of the articles? Great. That's the first time we've had 100% participation that I can recollect. So dig in and let's hear some ideas. But first, let's see which one to go after first. Tanya?
Do you want to start with most useful or one that causes tension?
Okay, thumbs up for tension. Thumbs up for valuable.
Most
All
useful.
right. Yes,
All
that's
right.
your answer.
Here we go. Three-way tie. Somebody's got to break it. All right, there we go. Ooh, it is a pretty good split. Let's share your results. So edging out slightly, reimagining work as a product. That is one of the most distributed results I recall seeing. So it's going to be a great conversation.
I think it's just a compliment to the curators.
All right, I will shut that down and you're good to go.
All right, so a big question. The idea of creating of work as a product for workers, is that foreign, just another way of saying something that you've always thought about and worked around, or how did that strike you? Anybody?
Sorry, Jim, I was typing about the additional article that we read. Can you ask that question again?
Yeah, the idea of work as a product that organizations sell to individuals, and as something that individuals shop around for, to look for a job that is a product worth investing themselves in.
I think it's really important. I think it's really, I think that it's a neat way to look at it, like product, like, you know, and thinking about employee experience and like the different generations that we have, working together at work and the different demands of like the incoming generations into work. I think that it's going to be increasingly important to be able to retain talent, especially as people are like draining away towards like side hustles and starting their own companies and all of these things. So I think it's really useful and very timely. That's how it hit me.
Strike a chord with anybody, positive or negative?
Hi, this is Lisa. And given I've researched mission alignment relative to productivity and remote work, the idea of work as a product makes me think about that there's congruence between the individual's values and the company values, which provides for a much more productive and satisfying relationship, which then increases productivity. And productivity really is productivity. So some aspects of the article did resonate.
What about design considerations?
That was kind of my question, because I thought, pretty frequently we always see the results back with people leaving jobs as work-life balance, which wasn't a job to be done. That is, they don't like somebody else's deadlines and lack of planning and those kind of things is what that means. Didn't see a way in there that that would be addressed. And then the other thing is, it seems like some of these things have manifested themselves, but it's for, high-end roles and in-demand roles. It doesn't seem to make its way to more generic type things. It's only in a competitive market, in other words. So nice idea, but it wondered about the actual practicality and implementation of it.
Yeah, I had a similar reaction. Like, it's sort of an interesting way to look at it, but I just wasn't sure, and I'm curious about other people's experience, that this would be something a company, that most companies, unless they really have a talent shortage, would invest in. And like, I get, of course, we all in this group talk about, it's more productive, people will, come up with better ideas, but realistically, would somebody invest in this?
So one thing that struck me, is it Gina or Jenna? I'm sorry.
It is Gina. Great guess.
Gina. Thank you. Oh, yeah. I don't know. Thank you. One thing that struck me, Gina, when you were talking is, like customer experience roles or customer experience and product design and those kinds of things. What's cool about those processes is that they have a bunch of feedback loops in them. Like, that's kind of like part and parcel of the CX design. And so if you have those same feedback loops, and I think that we try a little bit in HR space with engagement scores and whatnot, but I think that that's like kind of maybe one of the things that this article suggests that we could do better with a more experience lens that would actually tease out, like, are you leaving because of like life work balance? And then is that something that the company could address by making changes and stuff? And the CX stuff is really like collect the, actionable observations from your customers and feedback them in, and then make actual changes to your products to encourage loyalty and adoption. And if you have those same feedback loops and you actually act on them, like getting the sponsorship to actually pull through engagement scores and those kinds of things, I think it could be really powerful. And I feel like we kind of almost get there, but like pull it, like taking that process all the way through like an experience construct is probably where the improvement could come from more of a people-centered lens. But I don't know if that was just blathering or if that was.
No, I completely agree with that. That was my observation. I mean, people tell you they're leaving because of work-life balance. You could apply this approach. It doesn't happen unless it's a very competitive, environment. It doesn't make its way to jobs like you did. So that was where I thought, and it didn't talk about that.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
I said I kind of get cranky at these things. There's a diagram in there, in the article, and the diagram is not congruent with the argument that they're making. They're conflating leadership and individuals in the same diagram. Sort of brings puts a shade on it that actually reinforces what Jardina and Gina said, is that, it's focused on a subset of employees somewhat, and it fulfills a need that the data that they even present doesn't rationalize or doesn't justify. As an example, if you go to there's one click in there that takes you to another article, and they actually say most people leave their jobs because of their boss and their coworkers. They're taking too much of their emotional energy out of the job, and so they move on. And then number two is work-life balance. And interestingly enough, like number five on that list was compensation. So the idea of individualizing things seems like a great design principle for organizations, for job design. Consideration of career development and individual interest also seems like a really good idea. It's just, and it's sort of the final really seems like a good idea to avoid is stop putting people who are really good at stuff into projects where they can only do what they're really good at. That their data actually says that that is an annoyance to people. I want to learn stuff. If I'm a learner, but I'm also really good at something, don't keep sticking me in the thing I'm really good at. Give me opportunities. So this idea, you know, there are other articles that we've had that talked about approaches that I've been talking to leaders about for a while now, especially the one about posting competency and experience requirements for projects and making it open to people to apply to join the teams cross-functionally, cross-organizationally, et cetera. And that seems to fit the need that's expressed here. Anything else on this one?
What are your thoughts on like what doing something like this would require of like middle managers, Jim and everybody? I kind of feel like the, like to even be able to do something like okay. this, we would need them to have like a much more like creative and flexible sort of approach to management that you know, I think a lot of leaders in today's world kind of feel like they're too bogged down with business stuff that they have to do to really invest in that time. And this seems to be like something that would be like a step too far from the challenges that so many middle managers face, you know, is that just our perpetual problem perhaps?
Well, I agree. I'm not going to answer the question, but I'm going to add to your question. That was my reaction too, is like, how much time and effort is it worth it? And then the other thing, when I look at a product and a few customer personas, you know, maybe you have one product with four customer personas. How many job personas do you have that were actually designing jobs to be done? Like there's a million jobs, like not a million, but there's way more jobs than you have product and persona, right? So now I'm going to go create a jobs to be done profile for all of the 5,000 job roles I have. It's like, it just seems like a lot.
Totally agree. A place where these ideas are being realized, one very large financial services company that I coached three junior executives in, and I've been working with them for over 12 years now. I started doing projects, et cetera. The idea is to redefine the job of a leader. Of a people leader. They refer to them as people leaders because their belief resulting from our work with them is that leaders exist all over the organization and very few of them have titles that suggest that they're a leader. They just happen to be people that others emulate and take advice from. So this idea that people leaders, middle managers, should really be managing the talent and not the work, and that they should have people who work for them who manage the work, is a revolutionary thought that gets people kind of scary, but it works. If the managers can step back and delegate and they can focus on individuals in their teams and the careers of those individuals, as well as their contribution to the future capabilities that the company needs, then they have time to do this. But they've got to give some stuff up. And that's a hard thing for a lot of people to do, is to give up what you're good at. Give up what you were hired for, give up what you're compensated for, et cetera. So then that requires HR to change the compensation system. Another point of resistance, because to the point of you've got hundreds of jobs, maybe thousands of jobs in an organization like that, but you've only got like 20 customer personas to work with. What are you designed to? And So the last point on that is that most of the middle managers don't have the information necessary to manage the combination of careers and future capability requirements, because they don't know what the future is. They're only notified, informed, and directed on delivering on existing promises. So it poses it, it's nice if you're not an organization design professional to think about, but I'm not sure that it's really all that helpful today in the real work. But do keep it in mind that people will leave, you know, if they become sort of put out by their colleagues, by their coworkers, they get a bad relationship with their boss, and they'll leave before they start worrying about how much money they make or even the work that they're doing.
Something that was kind of like related to that is like, I don't know, or maybe just like related to the actual implementation of this is kind of the whole like idea of like contractor versus full-time employee and like the actual agility of a job to be able to be changed like that. Because in my experiences working as a contractor, and then which is like very specialized towards the work that you're doing versus like a more regular job where it's kind of standardized, like I don't know how you can always implement something if everybody has like more of a standardized role, because it won't be as flexible. But
yeah, that wrangling between defining jobs and linking individuals to compensation plans is the major impediment. How are we going to measure this person versus that person? And this person versus what other companies are paying for the same work? Tough stuff. Okay, what was our number two? Hello, Tanya?
Yeah, I'm trying to get it open. Hold on.
Okay.
Here we go. Tie between digital natives and the supplemental reading.
Okay. So how about let's go digital natives. So this idea is that organizations or the people in organizations, I'm going to personalize, peopleize this kind of conversation though, is that that live in the digital world and have lived in the digital world are more amenable and successful at transforming work to capitalize on digital capabilities. I added in there a somewhat different point of view, and that said that organizations that have a culture that's in and work that is in constant repeated transformation more readily adopt digital solutions to work and apply them to work. So they're willing to change bigger things, more things, faster. Thoughts or takeaways, key takeaways from the article?
So Lisa, again, digital natives are, you know, those individuals that work wherever, and you can tap into a greater pool of talent if you're amenable to hiring these remote workers than looking at a 30-mile radius around your company or the relocation costs. And I think we've, again, the research I've done, I'm a research practitioner. I have a PhD, but I've also got 25 years of project management experience. So the research I've done clearly shows that productivity is not impaired by location. So your digital natives, your gig workers, they are as productive as long as they're suitable for the job. And again, if they have stronger mission alignment to the organization or to the purpose of the organization, they show higher productivity. So I don't know, we're so parochial about needing to see people to believe that they're productive. And also the comment on leadership is I looked at the application of quote commander's intent to leadership of remote workers. Commander's intent is a military principle that simply says through empowerment, delegated decision authority, and a myopic view of what the goal is, that a team can achieve great things without micromanagement, without continual direction, that if you empower them and you just kind of set up those ethical, regulatory, and financial guardrails, the team will produce at a much higher level than those that are in more of a transactional or a command and control leadership style. Mm-hmm. So the article resonates with me because this idea of leveraging talent anywhere in the world is just an advanced thinking on the part of leadership.
Any other big takeaways?
So I read this article differently than either of you have shared. I read it. So I went back. I just looked. They actually don't define digital native in the article. So
right.
I had a different assumption about what that meant. But of course, I looked at it through the lens of what I'm working on, which is a company whose competitors are, when we talk about digital native in that company, their competitors were a digital product that the company grew around. So they're organized very differently than my client, who was a hardware telecom company that now grew into a digital product. And it's a challenge because their competitors are eating their lunch, obviously. And to get them into being organized as a digital native company is a big bridge for them to cross, but they kind of have no choice because their competitors are eating their lunch, as I said. So it's a really interesting article to me when they talks about hiring from mindset rather than skill set, and things like that they view risk differently, right? So these, a Silicon Valley software company or digital native, or what I would consider digital native company, you know, they test and assess risk constantly, whereas an older company that originated around hardware have very long lead times, very risk averse.
Yep. Yeah, there's an interesting thing. One of the chief human resources officers at a healthcare company used in a conversation was the balance, the focus of non-digital oriented organizations is on the how of the what they do, and the focus on the digital or the tech savvy organizations is the focus on the what, regardless of the how. They're willing to change the how in a blink, but they're kind of resistant to changing the what they do. And this article sort of points out the fact that you got to be as adaptable in both dimensions, as she outlined her point there. There are a couple of things I put down here as a note that you might want to take a look at is, if you're not familiar with it, adaptive leadership. Adaptive leadership, skip the practices and just ask one of your favorite AI, Gen AI agents to give you the principles of adaptive leadership. I find them very useful in helping people coach their groups and their organizations through digital transformation. The other is constructive dialogue. Everybody, pretty much many people practice that. And the idea is not to start with a challenge, but to start with a idealized vision of a future state where the challenge has been resolved. And that then introduces the technology not as the solution, but the technology as a means to an end that is discovered by the org design, the co-designers in the organization design. That can be pretty powerful. The other is, again, Gen AI is ask for the principles behind strategic, what is it called? Doing, strategic doing. What are the principles behind strategic doing is another query. And then finally, capability thinking. So enterprise architects and IT architects are now just starting to get into the idea of the concept of thinking about capabilities and not jobs and reporting relationships and things like that, is get the capabilities nailed first. And those things have been getting some good response from people who are practicing with them at this point, not adopting them company-wide, but at least dabbling in the ideas. Any other observations on this? Go ahead, Serena.
I love that you called that out. I've been on a sabbatical for a while, and I became a certified business architect specifically because of the capabilities, because they look at things across functions and not so much in a job orientation. And it just like flips the script on the design that goes along with it. So I love capabilities thinking. I think it's so useful in so many different ways. I look at it from a risk management perspective a lot of the time, but it's just awesome. So if that's like new to anyone, that is like such a great rabbit hole to go down.
That it is. And it is, it is disorienting to all of those siloed organization performance improvement functions within organizations that, hey, you're all wrong and you're all right at the same time. The problem is when we add all of you together, we sometimes end up with zero. And we really want to end up with more than the sum of the parts. And it's a magic thing. Okay. And what was up next?
It was the supplemental reading.
Supplemental reading.
Where data-driven decisions. Data-driven decision making can go wrong.
Yeah.
5 pitfalls to avoid.
Does somebody want to offer something up on that?
I thought that was a good article because it just called it out. If you read it, just some of the things you can actually do, because I think this happens a lot where people, some people are sitting there with spreadsheets that are not close to what the situation is, and you can make some really bad decisions and not understand the repercussions. And so categorizing it that way was just a helpful reminder, even if you read it before. And I thought the ones they called out, there's like 37, I think, fallacies in logic. And the ones they picked out were the ones that seem most relevant to the to business environment. So I just thought they did a good job with it.
Is anybody working any quote digital transformation at this point?
Yeah, that's all we do. the point to the earlier article. Now, transformation is probably a subjective term, but yes, definitely working along those lines. What that article talked about. And I read it the same way too. I thought it was about the company more so than the people and the journey. So why did you relate those two? I'm curious, the decision article and then that question.
What was that?
You ask about the working in transforming companies, and I wonder why you related that to the decision article.
Well, I think one of the things that I hear and I experience in digital transformation quote kind of projects is that the data isn't worth that much. The data they're going to base all of their activities on, that over the years people have mucked up the data to make it work for them. And so when they go and they grab, for example, what's the GPS location of this building, they get back a social security number.
You're spot on with that. And then the other thing that is happening, you know, to working all over the world is people are making decisions that have never been anywhere. You know, they don't know the culture, they don't know the customs, they haven't even been there. So decisions are being made, you know, for different places. That seems to be a problem as well. It fits into one of those categories. And like you said, bad data and bad assumptions.
Here's one for you. Think about intercontinental hotels. 17 brands of hotels all over the planet. And we discovered serendipitously that every one of the hotels that was booking reservations directly was ignoring the currency conversion in the registration system, and they were overriding it with their own calculations of currency. So IT mounted a project and fixed the system so that all of the currency conversions were synchronized and they were much more accurate than they had been before. And it totally mucked up the system that does the forecasting and the budgeting, because it had compensated for all of the errors that were being made in currency conversion at the local hotels. So they knew for years that they were overriding the numbers. And so they were constantly computing the difference between the two and compensating for it. And now all of the forecasting algorithms were wrong. So the AI that learned the forecasting was all wrong based on bad data. That's why I bring that up, is these data-driven decisions when you have bad data in the first place.
I think it's interesting because it makes you realize that really all data can always be cherry picked in some way, and it can always be twisted to fit either a political agenda, a business agenda, whatever it is. And so, like, I don't know, I think sometimes people, like, when they say, oh, this is a data driven decision, like they take it for like what it is instead of like digging into it. But then when you actually take the time to be like, hey, what does this actually mean? And can I, like, if I'm being presented the data, do I ask the person, like, okay, what does this mean? Can I explain it myself? And then once you get down to that level, then I think you can kind of see a little bit more of the light behind it. But yeah.
I think that's such a good point, Marissa. And that's why I love that this article gave the set there, the little table at the end, which I thought was useful, but it gave some good powerful questions to ask when people are using data as a weapon, because they can use it, like, well, kind of what you were saying, they use it to just shut down the whole conversation. Well, it's a data driven decision, so, you know, don't ask any questions.
And God forbid we talk about the parts of the decision that do not involve data that we can't access, or warm data that we're not evaluating, or, you know, anything like that.
Okay, who's up next?
Well, you have gotten through
three of the six.
The other two, we had two, one each for the step out of the lab and how Tessa Boshoff transformed Wall Street English.
Okay, well, I can't let my favorite one, which was Wall Street English, get by. So what are your thoughts on, you know, a VP of HR at an education company being successful at work remote, localization and globalization, digital transformation, and growing the business all at the same time?
I think it's so brilliant and I love it so much in all the ways, but she also had a corporate support function of 60 people. Which, when you think about the scale of some of the things that we're dealing with, it's much, much, much harder in larger organizations. But the principles behind it, I think, are fabulous.
I think it transcends a little bit more outside of stereotypical HR, in that it's like typically more siloed and more like broad scale transformation of what, I don't know where that sits, but like it's interesting to think about.
Did you pick up on the degree to which a lot of the thinking and suggesting was about the experience of the learner and the experience of the company employees, and working backwards from the experience to say, well, that means we need technology that works this way? If all the boxes get ticked, that's easy. But how to shape them and how to say, what priority do you put on the technology to deliver both an end user, a learner experience, and a learning development function experience and our employee experience all at the same time? I think that was just beyond comprehension of most leaders, period, coming at it from the experiential point of view.
I think a big part of that, Jim, that it was like a very small comment, but she said, you know, having these educators and these people who care about education within this company, like it was like she tied it to the meaning that people assign to their jobs, which I just think is so incredible. And so then it really becomes like a very purpose-driven transformation that, like, to your point, Marissa, like transcends the silos and those kinds of things. I agree with you a lot. I think it's great.
Any other thoughts?
The education space is interesting in and of itself, just because it's something that's, I think it's very altruistically driven. And so when it's tied, when like the mission of the organization is something like that, it's something that I don't know, like allows people to have a greater buy-in. And so I think that probably helped as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we are, did we have one more article? Agility and guardrails.
It's like nobody liked that one.
Didn't get any votes.
Well, there was the step out of the lab. Did you?
Oh, right. That one too.
Review that one. One person voted for that.
Oh, okay. I just offer that in the step out of the lab, there's sort of a couple of schools of thought, that one of which has faded into the background, but I think is most powerful. This current thing about the stages of leadership, the five stages of leadership, you know, I got the position that I'm a leader, I can actually lead, and those types of things. There's in organization design, especially with regards to job and structure, is and the what I call the leadership information system design of org design, is the idea that leaders, successful leaders, if you follow their track historically, they started out being really good at something, better than everybody else. And they then sort of worked into a stage where they taught other people how to do what they do and know what they know, but they stopped doing what they do best. And then they get to another stage where they build organizations and teams that are able to do things that are greater than the sum of the knowledge, experience, and abilities of the members of the team. And you follow, you know, Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Bill Gates, et cetera, and you see that pattern in all of those people. And this article just comes at that same idea the same way, which is, it's as much about what leaders stop doing when they go from stage to stage as it is about what they do in the new stage, what they focus on. And by identifying where leaders are in those four stages, as a consultant, you can sum up estimate your challenge in getting them to transform their teams and support the transformation that's going on. So if you've got a financial executive who wants to be a CEO and is only a CFO to work through to the CEO role, then that's different from a financial executive that is just happy as a clam being a financial executive and doesn't want to go anywhere else and certainly does not want anything within that person's domain to change. So it's an interesting tool as a consultant to assess your steering committees, your sponsor executives, and your executive level stakeholders and senior manager stakeholders. What stage are they in? I think I actually looked up the original author. It's a Harvard Business Review article. Oh, I did. It's an article from Organization Dynamics, and the author is Paul Thompson. So if you can find a copy, or actually, since I know Paul and Robin and Norm, who are the co-authors of that, I can send you a copy if you're interested in that. I can send it to you, Tanya?
Absolutely.
Okay. Anything else for today? We're doing well on time.
All right. Well, then if you guys have a moment, if there's any ahas that you think would be fun to share with the community on LinkedIn that might engage, whether it's about one of the particular articles, I think maybe a little more so focused on just something that you're going to consider applying to your org design practice that we could share as an outcome of today's conversation, that would be great. I'll pass it along to the content team. And if it generates a post, great. If you're all feeling like, no, it was just too scattered, we talked about too many different things, then we'll leave it be as is. So just throw that in the chat.
I think I need to reflect on ahas and maybe synthesize a little bit more given the conversation. So Tanya, is it okay if I follow up with like an email or something?
Yes, absolutely. All right, so I'm going to stop the recording now.